From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzak Berlot, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I discussed last Saturday's campaign by Saudi women to get behind the wheel in defiance of the country's traditions. We'll also talk about the implications of a Bulgarian Roma child found living with a couple in Greece.
Yes, this is a clear case of discrimination based on perceptions of what the Roma population does. They're often thought of as thieves, as child traffickers.
And later, I'm joined by 2013 University of Oklahoma Water Prize winner, Ada Oko-Williams.
People are also unable to engage in economic and productive activities because they spend a lot of their time being sick.
And hydrogeologist Richard Taylor.
There's easily sufficient water. The problem really is the delivery of water to people.
A conversation about water and sanitation in Africa after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Berlot. Rebecca Cruz, a couple of interesting stories in the news this week. First, let's talk about these images of a Roma couple in Greece that were photographed with a blonde-haired child. Immediately, people started asking questions. The authorities came in, took the child from the couple, conducted DNA tests, and did find out that she was of Roma descent and found that she was born to a woman in Bulgaria who gave the child to the couple in Greece because she was too poor to raise the child on her own, which is, I think, a typical story that we might hear about Roma communities. But what really raised some concerns this week was that, you know, there are issues of prejudice and stereotypes. You know, Roma populations typically, you know, more dark complected. And so all of a sudden you see this blonde, blue-eyed child and it raises questions, really. I mean, what do we think of this?
Well, unfortunately, this is nothing new. As you know, the Roma populations in Europe have been persecuted for generations. Nazis went after them. And even long before that, because they are so isolated from society and in some ways purposely so, there are about 12 million Roma, or what we might call gypsy, but Roma would be the better term, Roma in Europe, and about 300,000 of these are in Greece. And yes, this is a clear case of discrimination based on perceptions of what the Roma population does. They're often thought of as thieves, as child traffickers. There was also a case last week in Ireland where a similar situation, a blonde-haired child was taken from parents, and they did DNA tests, and these were in fact her parents. She just looked somewhat different from them. So it does raise some significant questions.
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, this population has been discriminated against often, but they do and have been known to engage in illicit activities, in criminal activities. They engage in theft because they are not well integrated in society. They are kept on the margins of society. It's not like they can go out and find normal jobs. It's a very difficult life that this population, by and large, leads in some way, and how people respect. And I think this whole story just kind of reflects that, right? That somebody who's blonde doesn't belong in that group.
Well, and there, of course, is the rub. If this was a child that was abducted, of course the officials have to do something. So they're kind of in a difficult situation as to know what to do. But in these couple of situations, very unfortunate.
Yeah, well, you're right. A very difficult situation. Well, turning to another region of the world, let's talk about Saudi Arabia and women that are driving into the spotlight by defying the country's ban against women behind the wheel. They're filming themselves. They're posting that on the internet. You can find all these videos of women saying, I'm defying, I'm engaging in activism and, you know, going to stand up against the Saudi authorities and the Saudi tradition that women cannot drive. Is this movement, you think, Rebecca, actually going to head toward the fast lane?
Well, this is the third such campaign of women getting behind the wheel in protest, another one here recently in 2011. And it does seem to be getting more and more notice, more interest. And I have heard some critiques, perhaps, that this is really not the issue that most Saudi women are concerned about. But I think for the activists, this is symbolic of the larger issues that Saudi women are facing in a country where they cannot own property, they cannot have a bank account, they can't leave their home. And so this is one very visible way that they can show their dislike of the system. And posting it on YouTube is also significant. Using that social media, which we know has been so effective in that part of the world in creating change in the last couple of years?
Well, that's the question, I guess, and what will be interesting to see is how this will create change. I mean, we know that the internet and being able to engage there definitely does. But, you know, it's kind of a solitary thing. You get in a car and you drive around, and the hope is that other people see you and that other people see on the internet, and it sparks this momentum, if you will, and people start, defying that authority. I guess it's more reflective, not so much of the driving itself, but just the limitation on the freedom of women in that country that is a particular concern. So,
well, and these women got out there. There were actually a number of men that were giving them a thumbs up. And there's a famous comedian that now has another YouTube video. It's off the old Bob Marley song. It's called No Woman, No Drive, which was kind of a satire. So they are getting a little bit of momentum and support, certainly externally from women's groups and others, human rights groups around the world, and then also internally from both women and men to some degree.
Well, we shall see if that movement actually picks up some speed. Thank you very much, Rebecca, for joining me once again on the Roundtable.
Thank you.
No woman, no drive. No woman, no drive.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this show or answer any questions you may have. You can engage in our conversation on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU or leave a comment on the Worldviews page of our website, KGOU.org. Next, I'll have a conversation about water and sanitation in Africa with the winner of the University of Oklahoma's 2013 International Water Prize, Ada Oko Williams, and hydrogeologist Richard Taylor.
In this bright future, you can't forget your past. So put your car key away.
I'm Suzette Gorlott, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. In September, the University of Oklahoma's Water Center honored Ada Oko Williams with the 2013 International Water Prize. The award recognizes significant achievements and service in issues of water and sanitation, especially in the world's poor and developing regions. I'll also speak with Richard Taylor, a hydrogeologist from University College London, who also delivered a keynote address at OU's Water Conference. Ada Oko Williams and Richard Taylor, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're here as part of the Water Center work that goes on here at the University of Oklahoma. And Ada, welcome to you and congratulations on winning the Water Prize this year.
Thank you very much.
So the both of you do work in different parts of Africa on issues of water, sanitation. And so maybe we could just start by giving some general sense of what are some of the significant challenges that African nations face today regarding water and sanitation. Ada, would you like to first talk about what you're doing specifically in West Africa?
Very specifically now in Africa, we're going through we're still at a time and a season where issues of water and sanitation, access to water and sanitation remains a very, very big and significant challenge for the governments and the people generally. So you have, like, for instance, Nigeria, which is my home country, with a population of over 160 million people. You're looking at only about 32% of the people in that country having access to sanitation. That means only about 32% of the people of Nigeria do have somewhere safe and decent to defecate. The rest of the population are either using facilities that are not up to international standards or are not safe or decent, you know, some sort of things that don't meet the international standards set for a place to defecate. And with regards to water, about 56% of the country alone, population of the country, has access to safe drinking water. So that means for the rest of the 44% of the people, where they get their drinking water, it's unimaginable because most of them have to depend on streams, ponds, and very unsafe sources of water. So these have attendant problems. When people don't have access to safe water, there are problems that come along with that. The well-known problems normally are health-related, and then people get sick and even die because they don't have safe water. But beyond that also, there are other dimensions to lack of access, and that could also affect the educational system. It affects attendance at school for children especially. It affects also health for women. Maternal and infant health is put to a great challenge, and people are also unable
to engage in economic and productive activities because they spend a lot of their time being sick because they have no access to water and sanitation. So the effect of not having this access, they are rippling and they kind of affect practically every sphere of life across the board. Not to talk of when a woman cannot, you know, so long as you're not productive and with a cultural setting that does not allow you enough, you know, a lot of access to social platforms where you can engage and self-develop, the issues of water and sanitation further exacerbate the problems that, you know, come from that. So kind of like this is kind of situation we have across Africa right now. Most countries in Africa are really way behind in terms of access to sanitation and water for their people.
So, Richard, has this been your experience as well in East Africa? I want to come back to some of the things that you're saying, Ada, but tell us a little bit about what's going on in East Africa and particularly the kind of biophysical work that you're doing.
Well, the situation in East Africa is actually very consistent with that in West Africa, similar limited access to safe water and to sanitation. One, many of the things, and in fact everything that Ada said, I think would apply to East Africa. So there's a consistency in the situation. One thing I'd like to add, that a common misperception from those outside of the region is that there's insufficient water. That there's, in fact, there's easily sufficient water. The problem really is the delivery of water to people, be it whether it's from a tap, from a borehole, from a protected spring, is really about the delivery of the water and distribution of the water, both in time and space, and the, if you want to call it, the conveyance, the infrastructure for providing that water. It's not really that Sub-Saharan Africa has some kind of chronic shortage of water. That's not the problem.
So the delivery and distribution of the water, as you say, is the biggest problem. But is the cleanliness, though, I mean, a problem? I mean, the sense of being able to provide the quality of the water, right?
Yeah. There are challenges regarding the quality of the water. Water supplies, if they're not adequately protected, can be contaminated not only by, human and animal feces, or by chemical contamination. There's even background natural chemical contamination, like you, for instance, would have, say, arsenic in Oklahoma. You have similar problems of fluoride and high iron, which is kind of undesirable for taste and use. So there are quality problems, but these are not really the main obstacles to the provision. They are a factor and an issue to address, but they're not the main factor. And I think that's sometimes a misconception outside.
My guests are Richard Taylor and Ada Oko-Williams, who both work on issues of water and sanitation in Africa. The University of Oklahoma honored Oko-Williams in September with its 2013 International Water Prize. More of our conversation right after this short break. I'm Suzette Gorlot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm joined today by Ada Oko-Williams, who just received the University of Oklahoma Water Center's 2013 International Water Prize, and Richard Taylor, a hydrogeologist from University College London. When we left off, he said there's a misconception that the water supply in Africa is insufficient, when the real problem is delivery and distribution. So then to go back to you, Ada, in terms of taking what Richard just said and putting it in that social context of, you know, the development aspect of this, and that it's not a matter of water supply or, you know, the fact that you have water. It's distributing it. It's providing good quality water. But there's a social part of this. And I think what's really interesting about your career is that you've been focusing on inspiring communities to take ownership of that development through participatory processes, to have local communities engaged in the critical analysis of their own situations. That's what's really remarkable about what you're doing and perhaps, you know, contributes to greater solutions some way. Can you tell us a little bit about your work in that area?
Yeah, excellent. Thank you. You know, like Richard mentioned, the problem isn't really that the resource is not there. The resource is there in good enough quantity, but the mechanisms for delivering, as he rightly said, and that is very closely tied to governance. So right now in Africa, in most countries in Africa, and from my experience, we have governance systems that are failing or have failed completely. So government is not responsive to its responsibility in terms of providing the framework that allows for different actors to get engaged and be able to deliver quality
you know, access to water and sanitation for the people. And so that's what led me in my career to begin to learn, okay, now we have failing systems or systems that are not able to cope or cannot respond to these responsibilities, but people have to get on. And so that's what takes us to begin to look at the smaller units, the community levels, the individual household levels. What can we then do in the face of these systems that cannot respond to its obligations, or sometimes, I mean, for several reasons. Sometimes for lack of just sheer will to do it, other times for lack of capacity or understanding of what to basically do. So we start with the community levels, and that's why my work is taking me to, you know, working with communities to do this kind of analysis, come to a situation and a realization that we need to take action by ourselves to address this problem, because at the end of the day, we suffer the most because of the system. So basically, we take the situation, we do the analysis, and come up with simple solutions that can be, you know, undertaken at community level within the community capacities to do that. And we've seen amazing changes and significant and amazing things happen at these levels. And, you know, one after the other, communities are beginning to realize that, yes, while in the face of this kind of situation, they cannot help, they can also do something on their own. So that's basically been the highlight of my career.
So can you give us a specific example of what kind of success you've seen at a local community level in terms of enhancing that capacity and encouraging their own local response to this problem, to, you know, this greater issue of poor governance?
Okay, now I'll take a particular example from Sierra Leone, where I presently live and work. And Sierra Leone is a small West African country of about 5 million people only. And this country has suffered, or is just emerging from, about 8 to 9 year old war. So it's a post-conflict environment, and people are concerned about rebuilding the country infrastructurally and otherwise, and that's putting a lot of pressure. And because of the war for so long, a lot of systems and structures for governance have been broken down. So walking and going into Sierra Leone, and then this is a country with only about 13% access to sanitation, for instance. Only about 13% of these 5 million people have anything close to a decent toilet. So working with these rural people and looking at the spectrum of the challenges that they face. So water and sanitation is just one of them, but they have other bigger issues that they have to deal with. But we had to, through participatory processes, sit down with communities, and particularly in the Pujong district area where I worked extensively, and Kenema district, to analyze their problems through participatory processes like the community-led to sanitation approach. That was a very powerful approach we used in terms of getting communities to come together and sit and discuss what the problems were and look inward to find the solutions. For example, these communities that were dealing with issues of even food security, having food, something to eat, water, education, and the range of it all, you know, the instability because of the war, the communal crisis, and, you know, the lack of trust between people because of what they had suffered through the war. I worked with these communities along with some colleagues to get communities to sit down and then address it. So now I can say, for example, a whole chiefdom within the community is totally open defecation free, and that means that everybody is constructed some basic latrine that they use. They have a water point through this process, and, you know, each community has a water point in the chiefdom, and then they now have access to safe drinking water and sanitation. But this, the beauty of the story is that beyond this access, the other problems I mentioned earlier, like education and attendance in school, that's increased significantly now. And then we have a situation where the women are engaging in more productive activities, and their income levels are beginning to also increase, which means people have more cash and can do so much more with their lives than they would ordinarily be able to do had these interventions not happened.
So that participatory process actually has a spillover effect and has an impact in other areas as well. So, Richard, back to you on your research regarding the impact of development as well as climate change on aquatic ecosystems. I mean, how does that relate to perhaps some of the work that ADA is doing?
What I would say is I venture to guess that the motivations that ADA and I have are actually quite similar. And what happened was I started out working in the NGO sector.
trying to provide water and sanitation services, or helping an NGO help communities provide water. And so I would be out there with people from at a kind of village scale, helping them auger wells and helping them dig pit latrines, helping with the specifications. But I'll tell you what happened. Many people who go through this, you sort of observe things at first hand, and then you have a kind of response. You see that there are problems, very, very serious problems to how, if you want to call it, again, we get back to this issue of delivery, the delivery of water and sanitation systems. And my response, actually, I guess because of my background, tended to be slightly more technical. I just saw lots of mistakes being repeated and opportunities that weren't being explored. And there was a very big problem, and there continues to be a bit of a problem, for instance, with being rather reflective. Of course, every development program is a success. Well, of course, they're not. Mm-hmm. And there didn't seem to be very much reflective work going on about what worked, what didn't work. And so it actually ended up pushing me, oddly, into academia, where I actually had where I could then dedicate myself to actually evaluating how development projects worked, why they didn't work. And I'm very much looked at this not from the socioeconomic perspective, but really from the biophysical. Where are the aquifers? Why was the well success rate so low? Why are some wells very susceptible and spring systems very susceptible to contamination? And so much of my work has now been trying to identify the magnitude of the resource, where you can find it, how best to protect that resource. And because obviously one very curious thing, I'll emphasize something that Ada said. One of the curious things, people worry that pit latrines and other systems are ultimately potentially contaminating the source that people are then developing, let's say a well or a spring. And we found something very interesting in our research in Kampala, in the urban areas of Kampala, Uganda, was that actually where you didn't have sanitation systems in place, it meant that people were, unfortunately, indiscriminately disposing of fecal waste at the surface. And actually this meant that actually water supplies were highly susceptible to runoff associated with heavy rains, which then went and contaminated water supplies. So a lot of my work is trying to protect the quantity and quality, or look at that in water resources. And more recently, I've been looking at what are the impacts, how climate change may impact these water resources that are being developed. Because, of course, there's no point in developing water supplies that are ultimately not sustainable in the long run.
Well, clearly the work that the both of you are doing is very important, and we thank you for that work. And we thank you for being here in Oklahoma to tell us your story. And again, Otto, congratulations on your water prize. And the best of luck to both of you as you continue this very important work at home.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Ada Oko-Williams, who won the 2013 International Water Prize from the University of Oklahoma's Water Center, and Richard Taylor, a hydrogeologist at University College London. We have a full transcript of this interview on our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of KGOU alongside the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Hillary Gibson prepares the research for our interviews, and Brian Hardzinski produces all of our audio and digital content. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Grelott.